Hello, and welcome everybody to... I gave up on the voice already. Tim and I are here, and we are going to do a 2016 year in review. We're going to cover Oscar nominations. We're going to cover what we think will win the Oscars for certain categories, what should win the Oscar for certain categories, along with our favorite films of the year. And between the two of us, we do have a lot of these similar favorite films, but none of those films got recognized by the Academy for the most part. Neon Demon, Nocturnal Animals are two big ones that Tim and I absolutely love. Tim was a huge Nice Guys fan. I liked it. I didn't love it. But there's a lot of stuff for us to cover. Like, I was a bigger Splash guy. I thought that film was great. Ralph Fiennes should have been nominated. But anyway, so Tim, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing great, and I'll try not to have too silky smooth a voice. I know you have some voice envy going on here,
Your voice is like a combination between NPR and like the smooth jazz radio station where that guy comes on to introduce, like, you know, the next Miles Davis song.
Exactly, you know? And you just heard Miles Davis jamming with Dave Brubeck in 1964.
Play music for me, Tim.
There you go. Hey, is Clint on our list? Did Clint have one out this year?
Clint
had Sully, that's right.
Yeah, he had Sully this year, and that movie kind of sank this award season. We did have Todd Komornicki on, who wrote the screenplay, so he was a super nice guy, and that pretty much binds me from saying anything bad about the movie.
There's nothing bad to say about it as far as I know, and it's an interesting point that my uncle, I think I've told you before, my uncle Kenny's a screenwriter, and he made the point about Sully when it came out that the screenwriter for it, for all of his movies, needs to get more credit, because Clint is very famous for, really at this juncture in his career too, he will come in and shoot what is on the page. He doesn't mess with screenplays. So the writer on a Clint Eastwood movie, this is just kind of a little aside here, the writer on any given Clint Eastwood movie is probably closer to the auteur on a Clint Eastwood movie than Clint is at this point. But anyway.
Yeah, that's certainly what Todd said. He said that Clint Eastwood comes in, shoots exactly what's on the script, doesn't change anything. He comes in under budget and ahead of schedule.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he's like a studio's dream, essentially.
He's John Ford. He's an old school hand. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, he learned from those guys, so that doesn't surprise me one bit.
I guess, I mean, quick thoughts on Sully. I wasn't blown away by it. I think that's probably Tom Hanks' best performance in a long time. Mm-hmm. I thought he was very good in it. He played something different. He played something different yet familiar at the same time, the everyman hero, which I think makes Tom Hanks, you know, our generation's Jimmy Stewart.
Absolutely.
The ordinary guy put into extraordinary situations. I felt that I didn't like American Sniper for a couple different reasons. I did not like American Sniper because I didn't like the formulaic template of it being a topical film.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was dishonest in a way. And now I'm going to compare that to Sully. I didn't feel Sully was dishonest, but I felt that Sully used the same exact template as American Sniper. Mm-hmm. This happened, the movie's over, here's the actual footage of the person.
Right.
But, no, I mean, I didn't love it, I didn't dislike it. I thought it was a good movie.
Yeah.
I don't think it should have been nominated for... Best Picture Director or Actor. But let's segue. I know you'll agree with me here. My biggest disappointment, which I know we all have disappointments every time the Academy rolls out their nominations, and we all have movies that we're very happy got nominated. Like The Lobster got screenplay. I was very happy The Lobster got screenplay. I think that film is smart. It's truly original, and it deals with, you know, online dating or how dating is in our society now in a very unique and fun way. Maybe not fun way, but in a very unique and original way.
Very stylized. It's one of the most stylized movies of the year. I mean, another one you could certainly argue is one of our favorites, The Neon Demon. But, yeah, the very stylized, rigid delivery of the dialogue and obviously the kind of ludicrous scenario that is set up, but it's all very symbolic for what you're talking about. How do people connect in the internet age? And the answer that the film comes to is not particularly well. So
no, I mean, I agree with you. I can certainly relate to it. I mean, I'm 32. Now I'm in a very nice relationship, and I'm happy. My overthinking notwithstanding, for which I talked about Tim off air. But anyway, she was in our, my girlfriend was in our Santa Barbara podcast, and she took a bunch of pictures. She's super awesome. I hope she doesn't listen to this. I don't know if she will or not. I actually don't think she will. That's how you know you're in a good, complacent, I shouldn't say complacent. That's when you know you're in a comfortable, secure relationship, when you stop watching YouTube videos that your significant other sends to you, or like stops reading your writing, you know, stuff like that. That's how you know, like, you've made it in a relationship.
Congratulations, Frank. You have now turned into your lady's old shoe.
Right.
You're nice, worn in. You got no more surprises for her. She's just going to slip you on every day and walk around.
Yeah,
this is
fine.
This is about as romantic as the lobster, if memory serves.
No,
so.
But anyway, back to the lobster. You know, I felt that way. I felt that way in my late 20s. I'm getting older. It's like, oh, you know, like, my friends are getting married. Half of them are divorced by now. But still, you know, and you know, there's Tinder, there's Bumble, there's Match.com. There is a plethora of different ways to meet people as opposed to the old school, like, bookstore, bar, concert, whatever. And
right.
It's like, I need to meet somebody now. Like, I feel like I need to meet somebody now, and I need to get into a relationship. I'm going to be 30, and then before I know it, I'm going to be 35. And it's like, you know, the clock is working. The shot clock is winding down. And it's like, I need to do something. I need to start a family. I need to be with somebody that's going to share everything that I love in life. Or I'm going to pretend to love the things that this person loves just so I can get into the security, so I can bang my fucking head against a table and make my nose bleed because the girl I'm dating has chronic nosebleeds. I mean, you know what I mean? And that's what I loved about The Lobster. I loved the originality of it. The aesthetic of it was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And the performances were great, too. I mean, Colin Farrell has been on this unique bender the past 5-6 years. I mean, True Detective, he's great. Lobster, I loved him in. I didn't see Fantastic Beasts. You saw that, didn't you? You have kids?
Yeah, I have kids, and they loved it. I did not see it. I'm not a Harry Potter, J.K. Rowling person.
I've never seen a Harry Potter movie.
Now, I've seen some of the movies, and Yates does pretty good work. And my daughter, whose opinion I do trust on this stuff, because she'll call a piece of shit. She's a teenager, so she loves to swear, so of course she'll call it a piece of shit. But she really liked it. She thought they did a much better job than what she was expecting. But I did not catch that one. But I agree with Farrell. I think he kind of came out of the gate early in his career and was an it guy, and then he got a reputation because I think he partied his ass off. Like, you know, who wouldn't?
Yeah, he made
that,
a sex
in that
tape.
Situation.
There was all sorts of shit
yeah.
that happened that kind of sank him for a little bit.
But I think everybody – I think he probably sobered up a little bit, and everybody realizes what a true professional actor he is. And back to The Lobster again real quick. The acting in that, I think, probably presents more of a challenge to an actor than just about any other kind of role, just because, again, it is so stylized and rigid. There's a rigidity to how clearly everyone in it is directed to deliver their lines and to emote in scenes. You know, it's just not like other films that way. And like you said, back to the Oscars, very nice to see that get a nod, because not that you thought it was going to get nominated for Best Picture and all sorts of stuff,
no.
But the fact that and Best Screenplay, Original Screenplay, is really a category where I think the Academy kind of loosens up sometimes and gives real credit to innovative filmmaking when they're not going to give a something like The Lobster a Best Picture nod because it's unique enough and quite frankly not seen widely enough for them to justify that, because this is certainly something of a popularity contest.
Right, and I've always looked at the screenplay awards, particularly original screenplay, as kind of like the runner-up to Best Picture. You know, this year, I think Manchester by the Sea is going to win Best Original Screenplay.
Probably.
But I think there is a very good chance La La Land might take it, depending on how the Academy goes. Let's talk about La La Land, because you and I will get into Nocturnal Animals in a bit, which we already did a whole podcast on, and then we'll get into Neon Demon. But La La Land is... I didn't watch it, but I saw a posting about, like, you know the Honest Trailers? The Honest Trailers thing? They retitled La La Land Hollywood Handjob, which I think is very appropriate, because I've seen the film four or five times in the past month, and the first time I watched it, I was underwhelmed. Not that I didn't think it was a good movie. I like musicals. I like the golden age of Hollywood. I thought it was really well done and crafted. There was just an insane amount of hype built up around this movie, and it's very difficult for a lot of movies to live up to that hype. But I'm watching the movie. Yeah, this is a good movie. I'm liking it. And then the final 15 minutes happen, and the final 15 minutes of La La Land is probably one of the best endings in a film I've ever seen in my entire life.
It's pretty incredible.
It makes the rest of the film that much better, and then the next time you watch the film, it's that much better, and the time after that, it's that much better. I can't say that I always agree with the Academy for their Best Picture nomination. Of course, this year I would give it, if I were the Academy, I'd give it to Nocturnal Animals. I think that would probably sweep most of the major categories for me, or if not that, the Neon Demon. But yeah. I think that La La Land is well-deserved. I think Damien Chazelle is going to win Best Director, no questions asked. I thought for a time Barry Jenkins might win Best Director, and it could be a split.
That could be a split. That may well be the split.
See, I don't,
right there,
I don't think it. I don't know. I think he's going to win Adapted Screenplay. He's going to win Adapted Screenplay. Lonergan for Manchester by the Sea is probably going to win Original Screenplay. Then La La Land's going to take the top two prizes. Yeah. I think that. You know, I have to tread carefully talking about this, but the Oscars so white backlash last year, while it had merit, I felt personally it was a bit nonsensical, considering a Mexican won Best Director 2 years in a row.
That's a very fair point. I think that the whole thing really happened. To me, the biggest injustice was Selma did not clean up in at least nominations. The fact that Ava DuVernay was not nominated for Best Director, number one, that's a really easy opportunity to, you know, make a lot of people who are concerned about this pretty happy, just to nominate an African-American woman director. Number two, she earned it. It's a great film. It's a great American movie about a great American story, and she should have been in there. And speaking of Ava DuVernay, just to pivot over to documentary, I think it's probably down to either 13th or I Am Not Your Negro. I have not seen the latter. The former is streaming on Netflix.
You think those two are going to win? One of those two is going to win?
I think so. Well, I think in the Oscar so white realm, it would make sense that they would get some love. Number two, 13th is amazing. It deserves every kudo, every award that it gets, because that floored me, and I think it floors just about anybody who sees it. I've heard very good things about I Am Not Your Negro. I almost went and saw it this weekend, but it didn't quite work out. I don't know, and I'm just kind of taking a look here, scrolling through.
I think, without a doubt, O.J. Simpson, Made in America, is going to win the Oscar.
Oh, I don't know about that one. I think the length is going to kill it. I think that's the problem, because I'll bet you there are a lot of Oscar voters.
It's 6 hours, dude.
Who didn't sit through it. No, I know. But I agree that it's right up there, because it's amazing in all the right and wrong ways. I mean, it is the definitive telling of that god-awful story. And I mean, from beginning to end, the first 2 hours is all about what a great guy OJ is, and then.
Did you watch? Not to cut you off or to deviate, but did you watch the FX show?
Yes, I watched Made in America, or Made in America is the documentary one.
People versus OJ Simpson. Right.
I watched every minute of both of them. Yes.
Okay. Cool. Yeah, this was quite an interesting year in regards to OJ Simpson and, you know, the whole race relations that came out of that. Yeah, I mean, you could be right. I think that the O.J. Simpson documentary is a lock, but you very well could be right. Mm-hmm. I just want to circle back slightly. Last year, that was the big one, Selma. Selma mm-hmm. getting ignored was the big one. The other big one was Idris Elba not getting nominated for Beasts of No Nation, which was a Netflix film that got a one-night release to be mm-hmm. eligible for the awards season. Now, Idris Elba won the SAG for it. He was great in the movie. But he didn't get an Oscar nomination. It's not because he was black. It was because it was a Netflix film, and the Academy would not acknowledge it. That's how I honestly
They weren't feel. Quite there yet, and I think you're seeing 13th, which was released directly to Netflix. I don't know if it's had any kind of theatrical run.
It had to have. It's like the O.J. Simpson doc got a theatrical release, a separate theatrical release. I think they broke it into six parts or four parts or something like that. But that's the thing. It's like the big news this week, aside from the whole Batman clusterfuck with the internet burning down about that, which Tim and I will get into because we also want to talk about DC films a little bit if we have enough time. Anyway, the big story this week was Martin Scorsese is taking The Irishman that is going to reunite him with Robert De Niro, Harvey Keitel, maybe Joe Pesci, and also, for the first time, he's going to be working with Al Pacino in an epic mob story about the hitman who supposedly killed Jimmy Hoffa. Now, this is going to Netflix. That was the huge fucking deal this week. I mean, it really was like cinema's dead. Martin Scorsese's next film is going to be a Netflix exclusive. Now, honestly, Scorsese did this because he got so fucked by Paramount with the release of Silence. Silence came and went. There was nothing but years and years and years of buildup of that film. He finally made it. It is just this fucking epic, sweeping film, and it just gets destroyed. I mean, I shouldn't say destroyed, but it just gets blown away. There was no campaign for it. I mean, there wasn't really advertising for it. But that's the big deal. And I think it's also good to mention that Manchester by the Sea is an Amazon Studios release.
It is.
As well as The Neon Demon. But the distribution's a bit differently for those two films because they come out theatrically first. They wait their three-month period until, you know, home video, and then they will be available to stream for free for Amazon Prime members. Now, Netflix doesn't have the same model. A lot of people are flipping shit about it. A lot of people, you know, like Joel, Ben, the guys that write for PTS. I think that Netflix is going to change their model a little bit for the Scorsese movie.
Probably. I wouldn't be surprised.
I think it's going to get a theatrical run.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think it should. I mean, I hope it does, partly because I'm a fussy old man and I still like to see things on a big screen, but also because I think when you get that level of talent together, and I'm not just talking about the cast, I'm talking about Marty, I'm talking about Thelma, talking about, you know, whoever he has shoot it, you want to see that. That is deserving of the big screen treatment, even if it is for a limited run before it becomes a streaming. I mean, I hope that you are right and that they do change their model, and that as they are getting into more original cinematic level content, that they push things into the theaters, even if it is for a limited run. We all know at this point of the game that it's first weekend box office and then whatever, you know.
Right.
And then it's first weekend in the United States and it's the worldwide stuff. And, you know, nothing has any legs anymore except for the occasional comic book movie. But they they could do their part, and I hope they do their part to keep the theater experience alive, because I think that still remains something that people around the world love, and I think it remains something that films really benefit from. I know so many people talking about, just jumping over to a favorite of mine, The Witch from this year, from early in 2016. I saw that in the theater, and not only was it a very enveloping, just dread-inducing kind of thing, but so many people that I talked to after that had a lot of problem with the dialogue. And I said, well, how'd you watch it? Well, I watched it on my laptop while I was doing something, right? You know, I watched it on my TV, that kind of thing. And it was a great example to me of how when you're sitting in a theater and you're not doing anything but paying attention to the damn movie on a big screen in front of you, the dialogue flowed just fine. It's the theater experience to me is so important even in this age, especially in this age, because we are in the age of distraction, because it's so easy to, and I do this, I'm snapping at my daughter all the time, because we will sit down to watch a movie and she will be on her phone the whole time. And she'll look up about every 20 minutes. And I'll say, what'd you think of that scene? And she'll say, and I'm like, yeah, you weren't paying attention. And I think more and more people are watching like that, which is why the theater remains so vital. Anyway, tangent over.
No, I agree with you. I did see The Witch in the theater as well. You gave me the digital copy, which was very nice of you. I love The Witch. I do not care for horror movies all that much. I loved It Follows, which was last year.
Yes, that's one of my favorite.
I loved It Follows. Babadook, Mr. Babadook, I was very underwhelmed with. Maybe the movie went over.
Yeah, that
wasn't
one of my favorites.
Yeah, okay,
it's
good.
Okay.
I loved The Witch this year. I saw it in theaters. When I saw it in theaters, I was like, what the fuck's going on with this projector? The movie's in, like, full screen. You know what I mean? Do you remember that? Because the aspect ratio of the film is cut down. I don't know what the aspect ratio is of it, but it's boxy. It's not widescreen. And it's purposely done that way. And I was like, what the fuck? Anyway, we both sound like idiots now because neither one of us know the aspect ratio. But hey, that's okay. I'm guilty of this. But, you know, the theater chains are dying. What's going to be left... they're going the way of Blockbuster, Hollywood Video, Best Buy, Circuit City, everything. They're dying.
Yep.
Because of digital media. And don't get me wrong, man, I love physical media. My fucking place is just covered. I mean, I've just got DVDs, vinyl, fucking Blu-rays, Laserdiscs. I mean, I have all books, all sorts of shit here. But I do have a big digital library on Vudu. I love it. I love the convenience of it. I love watching it on my TV, going to my bedroom, putting something on my iPad, and falling asleep.
Yeah, I love the convenience of having your Vudu login, I'll be honest.
Yeah, I mean, no, I love Vudu. I think digital copies are great. But also at the same time, I think what's going to be left in 5-10 years is we're going to have one or two big theater chains that are going to be left open. They're going to be more sparse than they are now, and they're going to be for Marvel, Star Wars, DC, animated movies, whatever the big James Bond, whatever these gigantic movies are that are going to come out that you literally have to go see on the big screen.
Yes.
Scott Mendelson of Forbes, quick plug, he wrote a good article the other day talking about this, and then he made a comment of, it was essentially about Scorsese going to Netflix with The Irishman, but essentially his point was being made that people are going to see Star Wars in the movie theaters, but they're waiting to watch The Nice Guys at home.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I watched The Nice Guys at home. I didn't go see The Nice Guys in theaters. There's a lot of movies that, regrettably, Hacksaw Ridge, I should have seen that movie in the theater. I'm an
that
idiot
That would have looked great on a big screen, I think, especially
the
back half of it. Sure.
But I watched that film last night, and... let's talk about Hacksaw Ridge, because that's nominated for Best Picture, it's nominated for Director, it's nominated for Score, it's nominated for Editing, it's nominated for Sound Design, it's nominated for Actor, it's got a ton of nominations. The first thing you can take away from this is Mel Gibson's back.
I think all of those nominations are very much a direct message to Mel that, okay, you have been off in purgatory for a decade or so because of the stupid shit you didn't said when you were loaded. You know, the guy had drug and alcohol problems. I think that accounts for a fair amount of the problems that he's had. And I think he has quietly, you know, he's made a few thrillers as an actor, and he directed this, which is a very old-fashioned, golly gee whiz, American hero narrative.
Right. No, I mean, this movie's like it came out of the early 60s. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is like A Bridge Too Far, The Great Escape, The Longest Day. That's what this movie's like. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, no, I mean, I think everything's forgiven. The movie's not going to win Best Picture. It's not going to win Best Director. It's not going to win Best Actor. It'll probably win Sound.
It could win Sound or Editing, something like that. I'm not sure what the competition looks like.
I think La La Land's probably going to sweep most of the tech awards, but I think that Hacksaw Ridge will win a tech award. But back to Mel Gibson being really... Bloodfather came out this year. I love Bloodfather. I think he is still a great presence on screen. Mm-hmm. I think that... well, to deviate quickly, I know the big rumor that gets me really hard is Mel Gibson directing Suicide Squad 2 or Warner Brothers getting him to direct a DC property. I think if he does that, and I think he will, then he's going to be back. Because it's boom. Tentpole, Mel Gibson film, you know, I'm given a project that has a lot of value that if I fuck this up, I'm fucked. But Hacksaw Ridge was a smaller film that snowballed into something bigger.
Yes.
But with Hacksaw Ridge, I'm actually surprised at how much I like the film, and the more I think about it, I like it. When the trailer dropped, I was underwhelmed by the trailer because I thought that the overall message of religious conviction and devotion was going to be heavy-handed and become overbearing and take away from the story in a way that Crash was.
Yes.
And while it is a bit heavy-handed, I think that... it's undeniable that this guy was a fucking hero.
Oh, yeah. No.
I mean,
if you don't know the story, if you're listening to this and you haven't, you know, check out the story. Check out the movie, because it's an entertaining. It's well told.
The hero worship is well deserved with this movie. But what this film really reminded me of was that Mel Gibson is one of the best visual storytellers working today. I think to Braveheart. I think to The Passion of the Christ, which is a film I don't care for, but visually it's amazing. Apocalypto is incredible. But this, I think that this film has the best war battle sequences since The Thin Red Line.
I would agree. Yeah, I mean, certainly World War II, and I don't know how many World War II flicks we've had since Thin Red Line, but yes, they are extremely well done. I mean, it's funny, we were talking about Clint Eastwood earlier. Here's another example of an actor turned director who just internalized all the good stuff from all the good people that he worked with over the years before he got behind the camera. And you see it pretty much every time out. I can't think of a bad Mel Gibson directed movie. You know, even Man Without a Face. Is that the name of that?
Man Without a Face?
Years.
Yeah,
it's been years, but yes.
Where he's the Vietnam vet?
Yes. So he is another good studio hand, and I think if Warner Brothers hires him on to do Suicide Squad or anything else, as long as they, you know, get the screenplay pounded out and let him do his thing and not do to him what they did to poor David Ayer, then I'm sure they'll be fine. And that's probably as good a segue as any into one of your, I'm going to guess you'd call it your favorite comic book superhero movie of 2016, Suicide Squad. Is that fair?
Without a doubt. I was having a conversation with somebody earlier about this today, and pretty much my life has boiled down to being an unapologetic and fierce champion of the newly minted DC films and the Star Wars prequels, and I'm fucking perfectly fine with that, because somebody's got to do it, man, and that's going to be me. We're not going to talk about the Star Wars prequels, but, no. I think that this year, Warner Brothers decided to make a risky gamble on reinventing Batman. And I think that they succeeded, not to the degree that they wanted to, because that movie got a ton of Razzie nominations, and there's a ton of backlash, even to this day, of people bitching about the movie, bitching about Zack Snyder. I mean, if you think that Batman vs. Superman or Suicide Squad is the worst movie of the year, I implore you to check out The Shallows with Blake Lively. That's the shark movie where she's stuck on the buoy or whatever. I mean, watch that movie. I think that what Warner Brothers wanted to do was they wanted to make movies for adults by adults. Batman vs. Superman's an adult movie. Suicide Squad's an adult movie. Everything that they have done, from the marketing to the collectibles, have been catered towards adults. They want to... And here's where I think DC fucked up, because... Or I should say Warner Brothers fucked up, because... I mean, I'll be critical when I... I'll be realistically critical when I talk about this. Because you kind of have to group the two movies together in a way. They freaked out. They want to be Marvel. They can't be Marvel. They have a lot of catching up to do, because Marvel's been doing this for longer than that. Almost 10 years. They've been doing this for almost, I mean, a long-ass time, man.
Iron Man came out in 2008, so yes.
Yeah, they've been, I mean, and Marvel is a well-oiled machine. For as much as I don't care for the bulk of their films, they know exactly what they're doing, and they are doing it well beyond anybody's expectations, probably even their own. I think they're going to run into a bit of trouble here when a lot of the actors' contracts are up and the Infinity Wars movie's over, because they're not really going to have... I mean, I don't know what the direction's going to be after that, but anyway. But Warner Brothers... It was like they chickened out halfway through.
They totally did. Yeah.
They freaked the fuck out at the reception of Batman vs. Superman. It did really well the opening weekend. It still made a lot of money, but it underperformed.
It underperformed by modern, you know, by these modern gonzo insane numbers, but it was still a very successful movie worldwide. A lot of people saw it. A lot of people saw it twice.
Right.
But I agree, you know, talking about Marvel, and you know I'm a Marvel guy. I'm more of a Marvel guy.
No, I know you're a Marvel guy.
Marvel Comics. But they are clearly doing the whole four-quadrant thing. And I think Warner Brothers looked at what they had, you know, the most successful, the linchpin of any success that they've had in the comic book world has been Batman.
Right.
And they had great success with the Christopher Nolan grown-up, dark trio of films about Batman. And I think very much that the mission going forward, and if you go back and read around the time of Man of Steel coming together, that they wanted to continue that. They wanted Nolan's touch. They begged Nolan to be the godfather to the DC universe, and he was like, you know, I'll produce Man of Steel, but then I think I'm out. I'm going to go do my thing. And they were like, great, fine, yeah, that's great. And he picked Zack Snyder. They hit it off well, and they tried to make a more adult version of Superman, which I personally think they succeeded in quite nicely. And they doubled down on it when they brought Batman in. You're totally right. They want to make the comic book movies for grown-ups. They want them to be close to R-rated. They want them, or you know, perhaps soon we will see an R-rated one. Well, not after this.
I'm just going to interject real quick and then let you go. They fucked up, and they should have been the first R-rated superhero movie. I mean, Deadpool...
Suicide Squad should have been the first R-rated. I know Deadpool kind of beat
Suicide Squad is an R-rated movie without blood and fuck.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's what they do. I mean, that's the trick they've been pulling since the Nolan movies. Don't swear too much and don't show a drop of blood. I mean, The Dark Knight's one of the nastiest movies I've seen in a long time as far as villainous behavior, but you never see a drop of blood, so it's PG-13.
Right.
But yeah, no, they did. I mean, you go back to the original trailer for Suicide Squad, the first one that dropped at Comic-Con couple of years ago, and how that looked like David Ayer was about to level up, and it looked like DC was about to level up, and then somebody put together the fucking Guardians of the Galaxy trailer, and that was a hit, you know, because trailers are their own mini things in the internet age now that are reviewed and poured over, you know, as much as films used to be.
How many times have trailers been better than the movie?
Well,
I thought the American Sniper trailer was the greatest trailer ever.
Mm-hmm.
I was so pumped for that movie, and then when I saw the movie, it was something completely different.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I agree with you there. I think David Ayer is going to be just fine because he's going to be doing the Harley Quinn movie,
yep.
The Sirens of Gotham movie. He's not doing Suicide Squad 2 now because Mel Gibson and a couple other directors are being floated around for it. I think Gibson's the first choice, and if he decides to pass, then they're going to go to somebody else. But, yeah, they fucked up with Suicide Squad. I still love the movie. It is my favorite comic movie of the year. I love how messy and sloppy it is, and I don't want to get too coarse or lewd with my description of it, and I have to be very delicate with the way I describe it, but the movie is very anti-PC.
Mm-hmm.
I was scared to death of Will Smith being in this movie. Will Smith has been an Oscar bait for the past 15 years.
Yes.
When somewhere along the line, it was probably Ali, this guy wanted to win an Oscar, and he's been making nothing but, like, the soapy, overbloated dramas trying to win an Oscar.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't in Django Unchained because, you know, he wasn't, whatever happened with that, he essentially didn't want to, I don't think he wanted to ruin his image by being in a Tarantino.
Too racy, yeah.
Yeah, too racy, but then he's going to be in Suicide Squad, and it's like, oh, fuck, it's like, and then in the trailer, Will Smith says Suicide Squad, and it's like, Jesus Christ. But I'll tell you what, man, fucking, this is my favorite Will Smith performance. I think Will Smith is going back to his roots where he's playing the ghetto killer in this movie. I mean, he's just a straight killer. Jared Leto's the gangbanger Joker, because of course they had to reinvent the fucking wheel with the Joker for this film, because
right.
of Heath Ledger. I know you have issues with the Joker and you're not sold on him, but one thing we all can agree on when it comes to Suicide Squad is Margot Robbie as Harley Quinn is the greatest thing ever.
She owns it. She's the reason that movie works. And Will Smith, even though he, you know, those two are the two characters clearly who have the most
right. They're the lynch
thought out
of the film.
Thought out actual character arcs. You know, everyone else is just kind of standing there or shooting something. But she carries it, her charisma and just the overall, I think the love of the character that fans have really helped carry the day in that movie. But I mean, you got to admit, it's clearly a movie that was hacked up by the studio after Ayer probably put together a really good version originally. And that's what just, it's a little heartbreaking to me, but it is.
Right, no, I saw the theatrical version twice, two or three times in theaters, loved it. I bought the Blu-ray when it came out, and I watched the director's cut. I mean, the extended cut's nothing. I mean, there's a couple more scenes with Joker and Harley. It's 12 minutes longer.
Right.
It's not going to change the narrative at all. I mean, I feel the same way about the Batman vs. Superman narrative to a certain degree, even though that's, what, 45 minutes long or 30 minutes longer?
Yeah, another 30 minutes, which I think the primary thing to me that fixes is what the hell is going on with Superman at the beginning. The Superman introduction is way better, way more thought out, and it's explained what kind of skullduggery Luther and his Russian thugs are doing over in Africa, much more so than the theatrical cut. You go back and look at the theatrical cut, and I've watched both several times, because that is my favorite comic book movie of the year. Surprisingly enough, with Marvel putting out their big Civil War thing, I thought that was actually kind of a misfire from those guys. But the Superman story is so much better and so much clearer in Snyder's cut. Everything else, the other editions are fairly minor. But I just want to say real quick, first of all, I think once Wonder Woman comes out, we should have a straight-up state of the DC Affairs podcast, because I'd like to dive into both of these movies a lot more. But I think that this is one of the best Batman stories and best imagining of the character. I think this Superman that we are getting now with Snyder's films is the most interesting and most challenged of the Superman that we have seen. You know, Superman, it's really tough to have a character who's completely fucking invulnerable and a god and make that interesting. Ask Marvel with their guy Thor. They haven't figured out a way to make him interesting yet, and he's been in Lord knows how many movies now. This Superman, he had to choose to kill in the first movie, which I know is controversial, but it shouldn't be. They had to make it hard for him. Otherwise, what's the point? In this movie, he has to choose to die. I mean, that's good epic operatic comic book stuff, and I think it does great justice to the character. I can't wait to see what they do with him next. And Batman is just a great amalgam of all the best Batmans that we've seen before. You know, he's got a ton of Frank Miller, Dark Knight Returns in there. He's got enough of Bale. I feel like there are enough callbacks to other Batman comic books and films. There's a lot of love on display for the character in Batman versus Superman. So that's my favorite. Anyway, we should probably get back to the Oscars, the fancy stuff. We keep talking about the junk food here when we've got all this filet mignon going on. I want to go back to La La Land really quick, because I didn't get to come in on that one, because I've only seen it once. I loved it. I think it is my favorite film of the year. It is a nice Hollywood hand job, and that's fine. And it doesn't apologize for that. There's this weird internet backlash going on where people are picking at it. Well, it's not as good as the old musicals. Well, it's not this. It's not that. You know, given what it is, on its own terms, in its own little universe it sets up, it's glorious. It's lovely. It's funny too. That's another thing. I don't think people give it enough credit for what a great comedy it is, which is what the old musicals, when they were really hitting on all cylinders, were. At the end of the day, they were romantic comedies, and they do a great job with it. It's lovely to look at. Emma Stone is completely charming as this aspiring actress. Gosling, a little less charming, but that's the way the character is supposed to be. I don't think you're supposed to like him very much until the end, when he really makes his own personal sacrifice to go drag this gal out of her parents' house, this fucking audition. And that's to me the moment when you actually start to like the guy, and when you're supposed to. And I think before that, you're kind of putting up with him. But I really like it, and like you said, the ending is one of the best bittersweet endings of any film ever. It threw, to me, one of my favorite love letters to old Hollywood is Woody Allen's Purple Rose of Cairo, which is not a musical, but it's kind of a magical realism thing where this gal in the Depression, you know, gets whisked away by the star of her movie. The movie literally transports her, whereas movies usually just kind of figuratively transport the viewer. And at the end, it's over. You know, there was a magic moment there, but that kind of magic doesn't last. And this, to me, very much felt that same way. That you know, none of it's permanent, and don't take any of it for granted. And it was beautiful. Well, I walked out of there with a tear on my cheek for sure. You alive over there?
Yeah, no, I was just going to let there be a moment of...
A little moment of silence.
A little moment of silence after...
The tears might even return if it
people,
was long
people, enough. Yeah. People can absorb that. Well, no, I mean, I think La La Land boils down to a pure celebration of art, film, and how good it can make you feel. You know, it's more than escapism. It's more than a Hollywood hand job. It gives you an empowering feeling. It gives you an inspirational feeling. There is so much craft and so much love put into this film that it is literally oozing off of the screen. And I think that if somebody is really going to dog on this film, they're either being intentionally facetious or they're just an idiot. I truly think that La La Land is something special. And I know I caught a ton of shit for this because I said Damien Chazelle is the next Bob Fosse, which in retrospect sounds like a clickbait headline, which I hate. But I mean, hey, I interviewed him in Santa Barbara and my girlfriend talked to his girl. So pretty much Damien Chazelle and I are best friends.
Obviously.
So I'm shilling for him. But no, I mean, seriously, this guy is 32 years old. He's going to win the director Oscar. He's going to be the youngest best director ever. I'm fucking 10 days older than this guy. I think that this guy has such a laser-focused vision of what he wants to do that it's honestly gobsmacking. I mean, I think Whiplash is a near-perfect film. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that film. I love that film, the pacing, everything. And then to follow that up with La La Land, where the film opens with a one-shot 15-minute, you know, maybe it's not 15-minute, but like a 10-minute musical number on the fucking 101 in L.A. Like, people are stuck in traffic, and everybody's getting out and dancing on cars and shit. And it's one fluid camera movement. It's like, holy fuck. If that shit doesn't blow your socks off, I don't know what will.
Yeah. I mean, the whole thing is a love letter to being an artist, to chasing your dream and being an artist. You know, she's not a director. He's a musician. So it's not just about making films, per se. It's about chasing your dreams. And
it's about
passion. Some people might find that trite. But really, at the end of the day, you only got so much time on this planet to get things done. And I think movies like this are really important to give people a kick in the ass to go chase their dream a little harder than they have been, or a lot harder than they have been. And I guarantee you there's going to be music, film, literature, probably new art forms in the internet age that haven't even been named or created yet that are going to be directly inspired by this movie. There's kids out there. My kids are some of them. They're enraptured with La La Land. They thought it was glorious and unlike anything they'd ever seen. Granted, they're young, so they haven't seen a lot of musicals. But truly inspiring film. And that's why, at the end of the day, it's going to take it. It's going to sweep. There's going to be people who are mad. They're going to say that Moonlight got screwed. I do hope that Moonlight gets some love, and I think it's going to win something, and I think it might be, like you
said,
best adapted.
It's going to win adapted screenplay, and I always fuck up his first name. Mm-hmm.
Mahershala Ali
is going to win Best Supporting Actor.
I think that's very true, yes.
I think he is a lock. I'd love to see Michael Shannon pull an upset, but he is the sole representation of Nocturnal Animals at the Oscars, which is a fucking travesty.
It really is.
I have no idea how that movie didn't get Seamus McGarvey for cinematography, costume design, production design, editing, score.
Score
anyway,
is fantastic, yeah.
Anyway, no. Okay, so pretty much, you've heard Tim and I talk about a whole hour on Nocturnal Animals. We're pissed that the movie got shafted at the Oscars. Whatever. I think I'm going to sound like a pretentious film snob, which is fine because I kind of am, even though I own every Dolph Lundgren movie on DVD. But anyway, and Blu-ray. Anyway, I think that Nocturnal Animals, and this goes hand in hand with The Neon Demon, are a bit too smart.
They are a bit too smart, and looking at historically what the Academy rewards, they are way too dark. There's
even
too much
though,
darkness
even
going
though
on
the
there.
Academy gave everything to Birdman but screwed Keaton, which I'll never live that down.
No, that was pretty ridiculous.
Because who won that year? Oh, I mean, I know who won that year, but Eddie Redmayne for playing, you know, for playing Stephen Hawking, which is a really good performance, but give me a fucking break here.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I think, along with Nocturnal Animals and Neon Demon being too smart, they are very self-indulgent.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't like that kind of stuff, unless you're like Bob Fosse, or
right, unless you like, you know,
Quentin
cinema.
Tarantino, stuff like that. You know, and there's a lot of people who don't like Tarantino because he's self-indulgent.
Right.
But back to Moonlight, because we should talk about Moonlight for a little bit here. Mm-hmm. I think on the other side of the La La Land coin is Moonlight. Now, this is a three-act film that is about a black kid in Miami. You know, it's his childhood is the first act, his teenage years the second act, and then adulthood is the third act. Now, he's struggling to find out who he is. He also happens to be gay, and then he becomes, like, what, a gangbanger in the third act of the film, essentially. Mm-hmm. Or a wannabe. Now, this is a film that on the surface I can't relate to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't relate to any of this stuff. I mean, I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, middle-class neighborhood. You know, I've had a pretty good life. I can't complain. I can't relate to this story on a personal level. But you find yourself becoming more and more vested in this guy's life as you're watching it unfold, man.
Mm-hmm.
And you are forming a kinship with him, Mahershala Ali, Naomi Harris, who plays his mom, is this fucking train wreck, and it's like you begin to empathize and have compassion for her. I think Moonlight's fucking terrific.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's also an example of the power of cinema.
I thought, and I agree with you, obviously, and a good, a really good movies take you to places that you are not coming from your personal experience, and if they're doing it right. And I think Moonlight is a great example of that, where, yeah, you and I as suburban white boys from the Midwest don't have a lot in common with this kid's, with his journey. But at the same time, you know, it does two things simultaneously. Number one, you immediately become very sympathetic to him. And I give the actors who portray him all the credit in the world for that, because they're magnetic and they really draw you into his world. They do that. And number two, he is ultimately on a life journey of figuring out who he is, separating who he's going to be from who his quote-unquote dad was. We don't get to see his real dad, but the father figure we are offered was that drug dealer that he turns into. I think there is a sneaky universality to to some extent to the male experience of growing up and figuring out who you are, but to really a broader extent to anyone's experience. And kind of seeing the various barriers, socioeconomic, prejudicial, prejudicial against sexuality, kind of those kind of barriers that are thrown up in front of him. All of us have run into one or more of those kinds of barriers in one way or another. I mean, you can almost look at them as symbolic barriers if they're not personal barriers that you have had to overcome. I don't know. I think that's where there's a universality. I think that's why the film is really striking a chord with so many people, because there's this sneaky universality to the struggle of figuring out who you are. You know, at the end of the day, it's ultimately, in many ways, a very simple tale. And I also think there, interestingly enough, a friend of mine who happens to be gay was saying one of the reasons that the gay community has really embraced it, the LGBTQ community has, is because so many of the love stories that have been portrayed in major film that revolve around gay and lesbian relationships end so negatively. You know, you look at Brokeback Mountain and stuff like that, and he was saying, you know, we fucking love this because, look, he actually gets to be gay and happy. What a concept. why don't we see more in movies? And I hope that does kind of start a trend.
I agree with you, not to get too far off base, but, you know, I've long hailed Kiss of the Spider-Woman as the mainstream film with the mainstream sex symbol heterosexual star that William Hurt was in the 1980s that broke on through to the other side of making mainstream America aware that gay people exist and give them a voice. Now, there's been a lot of movies that have come out since then. I've had discussions with a lot of gay guys that I'm friends with. I shouldn't say I'm friends with a lot of gay. I know like three gay people.
Okay.
But I've had discussions with them about it. You know, we had David Kittredge who re-edited Studio 54 film. We had him on our podcast. You know, we kind of brought this up. He's openly gay, super sweet guy. He's awesome. And he went on this tear because I brought up Kiss of the Spider-Woman, and I was going to sound smart to the gay guy, and I was going to be like, well, I think Kiss of the Spider-Woman, you know, and he's just like, no, man. He's like, he rattled off a bunch of movies I've never heard of. A couple of them I've checked out since then. But essentially what he was saying, and this falls in line with Brokeback Mountain, I fucking love Brokeback Mountain. I think the fact Crash beat that movie is the biggest travesty in Academy history. But he said, essentially, along the lines of what you're saying, is it's always a sad story of the gay guy dying or getting fucked for love or whatever. But at the same time, he said it's also the gay guy turning the heterosexual guy gay.
Mm.
And, you know, it's just like, he's like, it's unrealistic. He's just like, you know, you fall in love with a straight guy and then, you know, he turns out, you know, you turn him gay. It's like, that doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
And Moonlight is that movie you're talking about. Moonlight is that happy movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Moonlight is that sweet.
It's
story.
Ultimately a very positive movie, which you don't know that it's necessarily going to go
that
direction.
It's shrouded in negativity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but it's empowering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's empowering and it's ultimately very sweet and has, you know, a good happy ending for these characters who kind of belong together and you kind of don't see it coming because of all of the other trappings, because you've seen so many movies about African American kids in the hood who have a terrible time.
Right.
Or gay kids who have a terrible time and hey, you know what? Let them win. It's okay. And I think that, you know, hopefully that's part of a mindset shift that's happening in this country, although you sure wouldn't know it to look at election results. But that's a whole other podcast, I suppose. Before we run out of time, I do want to pivot back to The Neon Demon, because that is one that you and I loved. When that came out this summer and I saw it at a sneak preview, my jaw was on the floor. I love Drive. I love Valhalla Rising. I am a Refn fan, but this far and away to me,
you're just not gonna bring up Only God Forgives. That's fine.
I like Only God Forgives, but I think even Refn would tell you he didn't quite stick the landing on the screenplay. I mean, I think he said as much that it's not as fully conceived, and that's the thing about this is that Neon Demon. Retrospect, once you've seen it all, once you've seen, you know, because you don't know. That's one of the great things about it. It keeps you on edge for the first, boy, all the way up until the last 15 minutes. You don't know what fucking direction it's going in, and that's a very interesting and almost different trick than most horror movies give you. Because there's not a bunch of jump scares or anything like that. That's not what he's interested in. But he's keeping you guessing on what direction it's going to go in. And once it goes in its ultimate direction, it just sticks the landing so nicely on this, you know, using the genre to go after, you know, quite frankly, how cutthroat the film industry is symbolically, even though we're in the fashion world in the movie, how cutthroat the fashion world is, how cutthroat the addiction to image and appearance over everything else. And really, to a great extent, and I've talked to several women who agree with me that how terrible women can be to each other. Instead of really working together to kind of rise up in industries, oftentimes it works exactly the opposite way. He sticks so many of those landings and does it with a film that's gorgeous, it's atmospheric, it has some really fucking creepy moments, and then he's like, oh, and you've been waiting for Refn to show up, and there's an extended ending that is just pure horror. Purely horrific, but in his typical style, just at an operatic level. And I loved it. I thought it was his smartest film to date and his most cohesive in many ways. Tell me what you thought about it.
I think that Refn is Terrence Malick on crack. I think that he found his voice a lot quicker and has progressed
a lot faster. You know, Malick made, you know, two movies in the 70s, Concrete Template, theatrical narrative. Thin Red Line, he found his voice. New World, he found it more. Tree of Life, he exploded. And now he's just making these abstract existential movies, which I love. Knight of Cups is one of my favorite movies of the year.
I was going to say, you got to mention that one, because I know you...
Yeah, everybody knows that, but back to Neon Demon. Neon Demon, he has progressed so quickly. I think Drive is a callback to Michael Mann. I think it's a callback to Thief, Manhunter, Friends of Eddie Coyle, films like that. That has a taut, cohesive narrative. You know what's going on. After that, you know, he starts to deviate a little bit, but I think the Neon Demon is just brilliant. You have no idea what is going on in that movie. You have no idea what's going to happen. You get the gist of it. It's like the fashion world's shitty, youth obsessed. You know, everybody's obsessed with beauty. Everybody's superficial, but it just takes these dark zigzags that throw you so far off course that your head's spinning while watching the movie, yet you cannot take your eyes off the screen because everything is so beautiful. Even when it's horrific, and even when Cliff Martinez's score starts to really get under your skin, I think that's his best score, by the way, and I'm a big proponent of his Drive score.
Yeah, he's a marvelous... Yeah, I love Cliff. And that's some of his best work with Neon Demon, for sure.
But... You know, you're sitting here watching the film, and it's just like, geez, I'm just uncomfortable. And I don't get uncomfortable in films that much, unless it's like Lars von Trier, which, you know, Refn's like the trio of Fosse, Lars von Trier, and Terrence Malick all rolled into one person. It's just a dangerous and explosive combo.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I the thing that I think of the most, aside from the final 15 minutes of the film, is Keanu Reeves.
Mm-hmm.
And that dream sequence that she has with him and the knife, and it's just like, holy shit, man. It's like, I have a hard time recommending this movie to people.
Mm-hmm. That is a harsh moment. And a harsh moment to... we keep getting those. There's, in retrospect, again, it's laid out perfectly, because she is being menaced. There are these moments of menace that come in a dream sequence, or a fucking cougar in her apartment, or, you know, there's... Everything's closing in on her, and you don't know it until it's too late. And that's for, you know, some horror movies are kind of dependent on their twist at the end. And I think Neon Demon has my favorite twist. And it's not as, oh, shoot, you know, that person's actually a monster kind of thing. I mean, I guess that is what happens, in fact.
Don't you think, in a way, that the film, she's Little Red Riding Hood, but
yeah,
she's the big bad wolf?
You are led to believe she may be turning into the big bad wolf, and then
it turns out all along.
Yeah, you think so, but really she's turning into fucking dinner, and it's pretty amazing trick.
She's being groomed,
mm-hmm,
and
yeah,
well fed. No, I get it. I'm a little disappointed the Academy didn't recognize it somewhere along the line. Score would have been a nice nod, but I mean, I get it. They were ballsy the past couple of years with The Revenant and with Birdman, and you know, I don't want to say La La Land's a step back, because it's not, but it's a traditional.
It's kind of safe, you know. It reminds you of some of the other. I think it earns it completely, but you know, well done love letters to cinema and Hollywood and whatnot are always going to get, you know, good play out there.
The Artist.
I was just thinking of that, The Artist. And I was, you know, like I was saying earlier about them avoiding dark stuff, I remember how floored I was when No Country for Old Men won Best Picture. Because that shit doesn't win out there. That's just not how it usually works.
What, it's like Silence of the Lambs, No Country for Old Men?
Mm-hmm.
That's it? I mean, realistically?
Yeah, the dark stuff doesn't go. So, I mean, you and I, and I think hopefully a growing cult of cinephiles out there, appreciate what Refn did with Neon Demon. But a movie that is that brutal in the third act, that, you know, I'm not thinking a movie that where an eyeball gets regurgitated and eaten is probably one that's going to, you know, that the Academy is going to have much love for. Because still, you know, even though they are trying to modernize, and you're seeing that in a more diverse, much more diverse crowd of nominees, which is great, there's still a lot of old white men who are casting the votes. That's it'll change over time, I'm sure, but it's not, they're not there yet. And that's not what those people want to see. Horror as a genre in general doesn't get Academy Award love. I mean, Silence of the Lambs, if you want to call it horror, it has horrific elements, obviously, and goes there as far as the gore several times. But that really is a pretty huge anomaly. Horror as a genre overall just doesn't get...
Not to deviate too far, but I mean, Silence of the Lambs is a perfect movie.
Oh, yeah. It's a perfect thriller, for sure. It absolutely is. So, you know, one more I wanted to mention, and I don't know if we've really talked about this that much, is Arrival. I was a huge fan of that. Makes me all the more excited to see what Blade Runner is going to look like this year. I still can't believe we're getting a new Alien movie and a new Blade Runner movie in 2017. That just blows my mind. But anyway, I studied linguistics a little bit in college, and to see that having to hack a language, you know, which is a gorgeous, mysterious language to watch unfold on screen during that film, that was a real hook for me instead of, well, we've got to figure out the biggest, best gun that can stop the aliens, which is usually what alien invade, you know, how do we kill these guys? That to me was a really fun, smart twist, and also the overall twist, the tragic twist about what's going on. And spoiler alert, everything you see that you think is a flashback is actually her seeing the future, which is a small but well-executed twist, and twist the knife in the viewer, I think, at the end there. I really liked it. I'm curious to see what it does at the Academy Awards, because I do think, again, it's the year of La La Land. I think you're right. I don't think it's going to win much. I think
You know what? That could steal adapted screenplay away from Barry Jenkins.
Yeah.
Eric Heissier, who we talked to, could win the Oscar for that, because the short story he based that on, I think, was like a 15-page story.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, he really flushed out that story. Here's the thing about Arrival. I saw it in theaters. I need to watch the movie again, and then a second time. I liked it. I wasn't wowed by it. I love Denis Villeneuve. I think Prisoners is fabulous. I think Sicario is just holy fuck.
Mm-hmm.
I think Sicario is great. There's two sticking points with me. I can't believe Amy Adams didn't get nominated for anything this year between Nocturnal Animals and Arrival. That's an abomination.
I think it's terrible. Yeah, I think she should be up there.
Plus, she was in Batman vs. Superman, and she is getting older, and she is embracing getting older, and so are all the filmmakers that are putting her in films. I love that Lois Lane is, you know, becoming a middle-aged woman. I think that's fabulous. She's not the hot starlet. Anyway, I think that Arrival is one of the smartest movies that have come out, not only for what you mentioned, but I thought the geopolitical aspect of that film was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like you got, you know, seven world leaders that all want to deal with something differently, you know,
yep.
And that's something that has never been touched upon in an quote-unquote alien invasion movie before.
Yeah, so, it plays well with the language aspect, too, that being a barrier. It's a very smart film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think that wraps up our ramble of our best of 2016.
That was a fine ramble. We could talk for two more hours about stuff, and you, the listener, would love every second of it, I'm sure.
Oh, I know.
But I would just say in closing, 2016 was a rough year in a lot of ways for a lot of people, but I will say it was a fucking great year for movies.
It was an amazing cinematic year.
Huge variety. A ton of talent, a ton of new talent, a lot of people that we've seen do a lot of good work, do some of their best work, and it makes me excited for 2017 and beyond, and it makes me excited for movies, which is something that I always want to be.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody, and Tim and I will be back next week with special guest, screenwriter Mark Protasevich.
Yeah, that's a good one. tune in.
That's a very good one, especially if you want to hear some stuff about DC.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And Old Boy Remake, and I Am Legend. A bunch of shit. That's a great chat. But anyway, thanks everybody for listening, and we'll see you next week.